My name is Martin Purnell and welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church and where we can meet and hear from those that have made their faith count. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening, especially in this particular episode. You can contact us as well by email, ogc@accessradio.biz. Please use this address as we are starting a mailing list, which will keep you informed of all the upcoming episodes and much more. The address again is ogc@accessradio.biz. So please enjoy a very special podcast, which we do every so often. For those listening outside the United Kingdom, you might not be aware that a general election is about to take place on the 4th of July in the year 2024, that is. I thought it'd be very interesting to learn about previous governments that have been shaped by Christians willing to make a stand for what they believe in. In a previous podcast, today's guest chose a leveller as a person he would like to meet for a meal to ask him questions. Our guest then shared who the levellers were and the importance of their Christian faith in taking a stand when it came to the politics of the day, even if it was in the mid-17th century, when there were less rights, i.e. basic democracy, and democracy was needed. I even mentioned to our guest, which became known as episode 77, that we should do a podcast on Christians in politics. And lo and behold, here it is. It gives me great pleasure to welcome back to Off-Grid Christianity, Ewan Russell Jones. Ewan, thank you so much for joining us today. For those that don't know who Ewan Russell Jones is, who is Ewan Russell Jones?
Well, hi, Martin. Yes, I'm glad to be back with you. And I'm now a retired kind of... a retired man, that's all we can say, really. I mean, I'm still trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up, really. But I've had a mixed career, as they say. I've studied theology and thinking I was going to teach theology that for most of my life. Ended up as a producer at the BBC, but did teach theology for a time in the States in the 1990s. And then from about 2011 onwards at Regent College in Vancouver. And one of the things I've always been interested in is this whole question of how faith relates to culture and how it relates to, you know, things that really matter to us on a day-by-day basis, which is our politics, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you listen to episode 77, you'll find out a lot more about the levellers. So hopefully we don't have to talk about them today because...
That's all I can talk about.
Well, I can throw in about the levellers being also a classic folk rock band as well, but that's slightly different. So today's podcast then, faith in politics, but more importantly, Ewan, faith wrestling with politics might be a better title.
Very much so.
And when you think about that, you think about, for a start, not just in the UK, but also in America, where you hear the stories about, oh, well, you know, in the USA, only a small percentage of Christians actually go and vote because... for whatever reason, they might put it down to God, I don't know. Apparently, the percentage of Christians voting in America is quite small. But then you have those that say, oh, yes, but if you're Christian, you have to vote Democrat, and because you can't vote Republican. And then you'll have the occasional person, most probably in Republican land, saying, no, you have to vote for us. You can't possibly vote Democrat. Goes on and on and on. I've had these conversations from day one of being a Christian. You know, if Jesus came back today, which political party would you vote for? So we've got so much to talk about.
We have.
Faith, wrestling in politics, history as well. Take it away, please, Ewan.
Yeah, well, I mean, we can wrestle with each other over these issues, isn't it? Which is why, you know, you don't talk about God and politics over a, you know, a kind of a nice meal, supposedly, in polite circles, you know, keep those off the conversation table. But actually, those are the most interesting things to talk about.
Yeah.
Certainly, as far as the Christian faith is concerned, you know, we've been wrestling over many, many of these issues almost since the beginning in terms of the Christian's duty with respect to the government of the day, the rulers, the powers that be, where Christians have got a duty to kind of step in line and where they've got a duty to stand in opposed to what the government of the day is doing. I mean, these are not new issues. And I think that image of wrestling with something is a really good image for Christians today, actually, because we know that it's not easy being a Christian in the 21st century, but it's never been easy being a Christian. Partly because, and it's not always because of the surrounding culture, it's because of what we're dealing with here, what we're confronted with in terms of this revelation that's come to us through scripture of who God is, mm-hmm. what we are, who we are and wrestling with not just issues, but actually wrestling with God himself. It's amazing that the central image in, you know, in the history of Israel is Jacob, isn't it? He becomes Israel. Mm-hmm. And he's a wrestler. How does he start off? He's actually wrestling with God at the Jabbok, this image of him having this kind of night there. And he's wrestling with an angel all night. Well, I mean, that's kind of an incredible image of faith. Where, you know, he's not just wrestling with his own conscience, as it were, but he's wrestling with a God who confronts us, demands something of us. You know, now what is it? How are we supposed to be in the world? Are we supposed to live in the world and relate to each other? How are we supposed to relate to the planet on which we live? You know, these are things that actually you can't avoid as a Christian.
Yeah, exactly. Before we look at the history then, let's just delve a bit further, that's okay. And the fact that you taught over in Vancouver, the well-known Bible College.
Yeah, it's a theological college for graduates. And so they don't just study the Bible there. It's Christian theology they're studying, but they're looking at history and, you know, philosophy and how the theological tradition, Christian tradition, has developed based on scripture, obviously.
And so consequently, you've got different people from different backgrounds, let alone from different countries, or should I even say different continents, coming there.
Yeah.
They're all bringing with them their own ideologies.
Yes.
So you've got a real melting pot. There's no going to be one right answer to, oh, well, you have to vote this, you have to vote that. So with that in mind, let's just get to the nub of this, first of all. For the people listening today that are thinking, well, as a Christian, should I vote? Should I not vote? Surely God will bring the right person to the power that is needed. What would you have said to the class if they asked you that question?
Yeah, well, you're dead right that people come from very, very different backgrounds. I mean, I remember one of the issues in Vancouver, which is a very, very Asian city now, is a great mix. It's probably one of the most Asian cities in North America.
Oh, really?
Lots of incomers came from Vietnam and from India, and but many, many from China, both from Hong Kong. First of all, when, you know, the handover was in sight from, you know, being a kind of British colony, handed it back to the Chinese in 99. You know, there were a lot of people who left at that point fearing what might happen. And then the influx of people from mainland China, when China became very, very prosperous in the early 2000s and later, and that's still going on. But the divisions that you find among Christian people, Christian Chinese in Vancouver today, is absolutely fascinating. You've got a group of people who feel, you know, the umbrella movement, the protest against what the Chinese government is doing, particularly on Hong Kong, they're right behind all of that. But then you've got another crowd of Chinese Christians who are, no, this is wrong. We shouldn't be opposing the government. We should be going along with respecting what they do and not causing trouble because it brings the name of Christ into disrepute. So, I mean, that is a very much a real issue for them. What I would say is that the responsibility to vote and the way we think about politics, it doesn't just come magically out of the Bible. You know, there's no magic answer to these things. But what we can see very clearly in scripture, almost from the word go, from the very beginning of Genesis, is that human beings have agency. We've been given a task by God to care for the planet, you know? So in Genesis 1, at the creation of men and women in the image of God, God gives them dominion. And that's quite a strong word.
Yeah.
Ruling over the other creatures and ruling over the earth. In Genesis 2, you get this image of tending the garden. That's what they're called to do. Adam's placed in the garden. And the word there is to serve it. That's part of the same calling. That we got agency, we have power, and we got to use it to fulfill our mandate, if you like, to be the image of God in the world. How do we exercise that power then? Is it a matter of stamping on people that we disagree with or making our mark wherever? Or is it actually in terms of this business of serving the garden, tending the garden, you know? So those images are both there from the very beginning of scripture, and you can see the kind of conflict. So certainly the questions that arise in our mind because of that very clash of images,
yeah,
of dominion on the one hand and of tending and serving the garden in the other way. But both of them have got this very strong notion of responsibility that can't be avoided, whether it's in terms of, you know, the exercise of power or the service of others, that can't be avoided. Now, that's what politics is finally about, I think, you know, or primarily about, and what we, why we should therefore seek to be engaged politically, not because we want to kind of assert and dominate everything, but because we know we have this mandate that comes from God to be his agent in the world, if you like. So human agency is really, really important. So I have no truck with the people who say, you know, I don't want to be part of this. Beam me up, Scotty. That is a kind of Christian image, actually.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the talk about sort of the end times and the rapture and beaming me up, it's basically a kind of dream that, you know, we're not responsible for this mess. That's somebody else's responsibility to work. No, the world runs through us, but the responsibility, the agency that we've been given by God is really, really important. So I don't think we can avoid this political question.
And you are in a fantastic position to discuss it, because in the last episode, episode 77, as we're now calling it, you made mention at the very end when we were doing the hero slot. And I said, who was your Christian hero? I can't remember who you chose, actually, which is a detriment to me. But what I do remember was you saying, well, actually, my mum did this. And of course, as soon as you said that, I came in with, well, tell me more about your mum, because we need to fly the flag for your mum. This is brilliant. And then in the next line, you said two words. The second word was Park. The first word was Bletchley. You had me hooked. 15 minutes later, we then got back to your Christian heroes.
Yes.
And a result of which, I had to go and buy the book your brother Gethin wrote about your mum, Hut 6. And
yeah.
Wow. And the reason why I'm saying this is that your mum
wasn't
a pacifist, because if she had been a pacifist, she wouldn't have been involved in the Second World War, let alone trying to find where the U-boats were in the oceans around the UK and everything else like that. No, she wanted to help out. Whereas your dad was the complete opposite. He was a pacifist.
Yeah.
So
that's right.
What do you remember of those times when, you know, you've got two ideologies here conflicting, yet they're in a marriage?
Yeah. Well, it's really fascinating looking back on it, because we didn't know for many years that my mother had been so central to the war effort, really. I mean, you know, we knew that she was involved. She served for the Foreign Office is all she would say. But then in the late 80s and 90s, the story really started coming out, because they could talk about it at that point. The Official Secrets Act had kind of run out and books were appearing on it all. I realized that Mum had played this really kind of critical role in the Second World War. What I'd known much more about was my father's conscientious objection. They started dating at this time. Mum was running the Christian Union in the university in Cardiff. Dad was a theological student, and they started going out together. In fact, their first date was for her to travel up to London to be interviewed at the Foreign Office for this job. And she wasn't supposed to tell anybody about what was happening. You know, she was just part of the war effort. But Dad obviously knew way more than, you know, he ever let on. I mean, he knew about Bletchley Park, for example. He'd been in there to get her out of there when she was very ill at one point. But what I do remember is very intense conversations with both of them. I mean, I would argue so much with my mother as a teenager. I was a stroppy teenager, but she was pretty stroppy too. She had her political views, and they were much more conservative than mine were. Mum came from a tradition which was basically the Welsh liberal tradition of Lloyd George, and, you know, which was heavily kind of connected with a certain strand of nonconformity in Wales, the Methodist Church, you know, the Methodistiaid Calvinaidd and the Presbyterians, and there were, you know, the Bedwyr and so on. That was very much the kind of nonconformist thing. But there was also the tradition that my father had grown up in, which was much more on the left, the Independent Labour Party, which my grandfather was a member of. He was a founder of his trade union and stuff like that. So there was a difference there as well in their stances. Now, clearly, Dad's pacifism wasn't related to that kind of left-wing thing. That was very much related to his Christian reading of the Gospels, and particularly of the Sermon on the Mount. And I sided with that as I was growing up. That's where I thought that's the Christian stance. But as I've grown old, as I grew older, and as, you know, I suppose adulthood comes on, you see what's happening politically. I still stayed kind of more on the left than where my mother was, but I could see that the struggles over what you do when you're faced with tyranny, you know, when you're faced with a person like Hitler, or later on with Stalin and his, you know, the people who followed on from Stalin, Brezhnev and people like that. What do you do in terms of confronting that with a genuine resistance to what was in many ways evil? You know, so I came to see my mother's stance much more and came to appreciate it much more, that she thought that this was unavoidable. She had to take responsibility. So there's a struggle here, but pacifism and the wanting to kind of disengage almost from this, I haven't got a dog in this fight sort of thing,
yeah,
to say, no, we are part of this and we've got to take a responsibility here. That is a struggle that goes on. And I think it's a struggle that goes on in terms of our, that's very much related to the issue of war, but it also relates more widely to our responsibility politically, because there's been also this divide in, are we going to disengage from society, basically create our Christian community and do our thing over there and not be troubled by these bigger, wider issues? Or do we say, no, we are part of this. We can't escape this. This is unavoidable. And more than that, we have a responsibility to nail our colours to the mast and to do what we can in fulfilment of our kind of God-given mandate.
Yeah, yeah. What also comes out of this is that something that's been lost since the advent of social media, this is my view on it, by the way, is communication, as in oral communication, talking. And you've got a husband and wife here in your scenario, as your mum and dad, opposing views, but they're prepared to talk about it.
Yeah.
And through love, let them carry on with their own ideologies, but support them in it as well.
Yeah.
So consequently, I would have thought that had they gone further into politics, and let's say your dad became leader of the Labour Party or whatever, he would at least seen a bit more of the understanding from the other side because of his wife. And this is something I think that we're losing now. And hopefully this podcast will address certain issues for people to then go and talk about it to their loved ones, saying, you know, faith actually is important. You need to think about this, and let's just talk. So I'm concerned that we will lose maybe some of our historical impact that Christians have had throughout the hundreds of years. We started off with the Levellers, and that they were prepared to stand up for their faith because they believed in what it said in the Bible, but it was their understanding of the Bible. But then obviously democracy was still in its infancy, if that's a better word for it.
Well, they were proposing democracy, which didn't really exist, you know, at that stage.
So we have to take a stand. So with this in mind then, Ewan, let's talk about some people who have done that you can say, yeah, that really has affected modern democracy. So who comes to mind first of all?
I think if we go back further than that, if we go back to the very beginnings of Christian society, if you like.
Okay.
You know, in the early centuries after the New Testament, you had just small groups of Christians growing, obviously, across the kind of Mediterranean world. And there was a lot of persecution, obviously, because they wouldn't go along with the society of the day, which was riddled with religion. It was riddled with idolatry. And one of the reasons that Christians wouldn't serve in the military, for example, in the early centuries, was because in order to be a soldier in the Roman army, you had to take part in these kind of religious rituals to other gods and sacrifice and all of that stuff. So that was one issue where they wouldn't serve in the military. And then the other issue was, if I'm a Christian, that's my first identity, not my nationhood or my political affiliation. My first affiliation is to Christ and to Christian brothers and sisters. Tertullian, who was kind of an early Christian thinker, says, you know, I can't go out and slay the barbarians in the name of the empire because Christ is also among the barbarians. You know, there was that issue. But then in 312, you get this conversion that has affected the whole of modern history, really, the conversion of an emperor.
Yeah.
Emperor Constantine becomes a Christian. Now, you know, it's very mysterious and controversial what happened to him, but it was the night before a battle.
Oh, was it?
The Battle of the Milvian Bridge. And he's thinking about, you know, how he's going to win and triumph in his part of the empire and stuff like that. And he has this experience. He meets Christ, apparently. It's a bit like a Damascus Road experience. And there are a couple of different accounts of it. But one of them, he sees, you know, a sign in the sky, a cross superimposed on the sun. And the message that he gets is, in this sign, conquer, right? Under the sign of the cross. Now,
right.
That changed the course of history. What did that mean, in this sign, conquer? Is that what Jesus wants us to do? To go out to battle, make people Christians, win military conflicts with the sign of the cross? Well, actually, through history, there have been Christians who really believed that.
Yeah.
In the Crusades, ministers, priests went around Europe, basically, calling people to take up their cross, to go and fight in the Crusades.
Yeah.
So to take the cross in those days was meant to go and be a crusader. Smite the Muslims and all that kind of stuff. Is that what Jesus wants?
Mm.
So you can look at that as a devastating moment when Christianity goes wrong, if you want. But actually, the conversion of the Emperor Constantine did mean something. And it wasn't just about winning battles. He actually thought, now we've got to end the persecution of Christians. We've got to end these barbaric treatment of prisoners and opponents of the emperor through crucifixion or throwing them to animals. And so he brought in a whole bunch of reforms that were really kind of humane.
Yes.
And you're thinking, yeah, there's really something going on here that is important. And reforms in society, reforms about how government is run, that are just tending much more towards a kind of humane, humanistic kind of vision for the whole of society. If you write off Constantine because of his militarism or taking up the cross idea, are you also going to write off this development that happened here where he was really trying to take responsibility as a Christian for the life of his society, the life of the city? Politics is all about the life of the city, isn't it? The life of the polis, that's all it is. And he believed, rightly or wrongly, that he'd been given this charge by Christ to go out and fight in his name, but he also believed that he was called upon to do certain things that, you know, you can only say they were biblical things, not to treat people who are made in the image of God with utter contempt through crucifixion and barbaric treatments in prison and throw into the animals, all those kind of things. So something happened there that is controversial, but that you can see he was struggling with his conscience and struggling to fulfill a kind of Christian vision. And of course, we get it wrong sometimes. Of course, Christians have got it wrong through history, but that struggle goes on.
Okay, we've got Constantine. We'll put a tick there. Who can we then look at, say, okay, this person might have shaped something that could be the start of democracy, say, here in UK?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to bang on about the levels again, because I did that last time. But yeah, yes, I mean, I think you can see through the Middle Ages, basically, that things are happening at a kind of very profound level within the law system, for example, and within government, where there's a kind of understanding of a human vision that's been deeply influenced by Christianity. There's a great book by Tom Holland, actually, called Dominion, where he set out to explore the impact of Christianity upon the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he wasn't coming at it particularly as a, you know, a Christian apologist or anything like that. He was coming at it as a historian, broadcaster.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant book, however, in which he shows how profoundly certain Christian principles have affected us all in the modern world now. Even people who you think are, you know, opponents of Christianity, actually, their attitudes have been deeply shaped by these ideas that are in the present in the Bible and present in the Christian story,
yeah.
Like service, like being willing to suffer for your principles and to not kind of impose yourself always on others. He says that these things are like depth charges, you know, they're kind of there almost from the beginning in the Bible and in the story of Jesus and in the early church. But their implications don't become apparent until much later. The explosion happens underwater, if you like, but then gradually the explosion comes up to the surface and it, you know, happens there and then it kind of ripples out. And, you know, some of these were happening in the Middle Ages. And I think one of those is the rights of individuals. It's not apparent to everybody, human rights. That's not a universal thing. We talk about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you know, issued by the UN in the 1940s and so on. But actually, these things are not self-evident. They come out of a biblical vision of human beings as made in the image of God. Every one of us, men and women of every race, of every, you know, we're made in the image of God. And therefore, we have a certain dignity, a certain right that belongs to us as human beings that can't be taken away. Now that that idea grows in the Middle Ages and it becomes more and more kind of embedded in the laws of Europe in different ways. And the implications of that become more and more apparent. And sometimes it comes through conflict. These kind of things are worked out just like in the Civil War in England in the 17th century, but it's kind of worked out over time. Now, that is a Christian, a biblical vision, you know, Judeo-Christian vision, that has been now a gift to, I would say, the whole of humanity.
Wow, that's a very powerful statement.
Yeah.
Why did you say that?
I think the language of rights has become so important in the modern world. And we talk about it now as though it's got no religious bearing whatsoever. Mm. It's got no religious background. Well, it doesn't come out of anywhere. It doesn't come out of other religious traditions. It comes out of this very specific biblical vision that human beings have been made by God and that we bear an imprint of God. And therefore, certain things belong to us that you mustn't mess with. So, for example, religious toleration, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There have obviously been despicable times in Christian history where Christians have tortured others in order to get them to believe the right stuff or to repent of their, you know, their wrong views or whatever. You know, so you have the Inquisition and that kind of thing. But along comes a guy like Roger Williams, Baptist in the 17th century, and he's picking up on things that have been said by others in other ways. And he says, it's wrong. You're doing something wrong to the conscience of man or woman if you force them to believe a certain thing that deep down in their hearts they can't believe. That's wrong. Because if you do that, you're forcing their conscience. You're forcing something that can't be done. They've got this deep conviction within them. You've got to respect that. That's part of their dignity as a human being made in the image of God. And therefore, that becomes then, if they've got this fundamental conviction in their conscience, you've got to respect it. You've got to award that a kind of respect in the law. You've got to award that a kind of, don't touch that then. You can't force somebody's conscience. You can't torture them to say something that really deep down they don't believe. Now, that's a deep, deep thing, that.
Yeah.
You know? But I believe that that has come out of a Christian understanding of the person. It didn't come out of an Enlightenment philosophical position. The Enlightenment may often be kind of portrayed as this kind of great enemy of Christianity, but actually it's an enlightenment that happened in Christian Europe. So the French thinkers of the Enlightenment, mm-hmm. often seen as kind of great kind of anti-Christian voices like Voltaire and so on, yeah. but they were deeply influenced in ways that they probably didn't even realize by a Christian understanding of the person, a biblical vision of the person. So you know, that's one of those depth charges that I think went off through the early centuries of Christianity, through the Middle Ages, been fought over and so, but it's become apparent. No, this is a truth that we now recognize as a truth of the human being.
And I think you can sum that up then from my very limited knowledge. But Mr. Bevan from Wales, who was yeah. very, very instrumental in the NHS, I don't think he was a Christian, but didn't he make reference to the fact that this depth charge thing that you are saying
yeah.
obviously welled up inside him and he needed to do something about it, hence the NHS of today?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Irene Bevan certainly wouldn't have described himself as a Christian. He may have described himself as an atheist even.
Yeah.
There's quite an amusing story about him going to a church service that he had to attend as a kind of government minister and stuff like that. And he walked out of it. It was a Catholic mass. And he said it offended his nonconformist conscience. You know, and that was quite an amusing one. You know, he's an atheist, but he's offended in a way that, you know, a Welsh Baptist might be or at that time. Another kind of funny story along that lines, I remember. I was making a film in Northern Ireland just when the Troubles were coming to an end.
Yeah.
We interviewed some guys from the IRA and the BBC were very, very careful about who we used, where the crew were all not from Northern Ireland because they didn't want a Welsh crew coming in and, you know, messing things up, basically, you know, not knowing the geography of the place mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And we talked to these IRA guys and it was a big step for journalists to take at the time and BBC, you know, because of policy and stuff like that. And these guys, they were very friendly, but they were very curious as to where the crew stood on all of this in terms of the politics of Northern Ireland. And I remember one of them asking my cameraman, you're Protestant or a Catholic? And the cameraman says, I'm an atheist. And the guy said, totally straight face, yeah, but are you a Catholic atheist or a Protestant atheist? You know, and I mean, you know, it's an absurd question on one level, but of course it isn't. And it actually recognizes this truth that in the European tradition, it's been deeply influenced by Christian ideas and religious ideas in ways we often don't recognize. And that certainly applies in the context of healthcare. So you think about health and what an Irene Bevan did there. He recognized that this desire to care is profound and that we are our brother's keepers. You know, why do you bring in a National Health Service? Now, this is deeply opposed still in the United States of America by Christians. You know, this is wrong. This is socialism. This is Marxism.
Mm.
No, an Irene Bevan was building on a long, long Christian tradition. And one of the amazing things, you go back into church history again, the Cappadocians, right? The Cappadocian fathers and mothers, people like Gregory and of Nyssa and Nazianzus and Basil and Macrina, they were a family actually. They kind of created in fifth century, you know, one of the first hospitals in the world that just cared for everybody in that community, regardless of their wealth and their, you know, they cared. Now, this was something that churches were doing across the Mediterranean world. They knew that it was their responsibility to care for the physical well-being of their neighbors, regardless of their kind of religious commitments. There was an emperor came in into power some decades after Constantine was, you know, started off this tradition of Christian emperors. One came along who said, no, I don't want to be a Christian. I want to go back to the old pagan days. He's known as Julian the Apostate. And Julian the Apostate sort of hated Christianity. I mean, he kind of despised Christians for turning their back on the old gods.
Yeah.
The old gods is what made Rome great, what made the empire great. And you're just kind of turned your back on that, you know, his lack of respect. And, you know, Rome's never going to be great again. Make Rome great again by taking up paganism again. But he wrote this fascinating letter to the pagan priests of the time, which actually Tom Holland talks about in his brilliant book Dominion. But he talks about this this letter where Julian complains to the priests. He says, look at what these Christian churches are doing, caring for their people, all these welfare schemes they've got. That's what we've always done. That's what we should be doing. And Tom Holland says, no, that's not what they were always doing. Even Julian the Apostate had been so influenced by Christian ideas by that stage that he saw the duty of religion to care for other people. That was a new idea. That wasn't part of the, you know, the widespread pagan temples there and their jobs. So that relationship between churches and hospitals and care, it goes deep in the European tradition, in the Western tradition, because of Christianity. And the NHS, I think, is not a kind of Marxist innovation. It's actually building on a deeply Christian insight that we care for each other. We take responsibility for each other.
I've got a feeling there was a Christian heavily involved in it. Maybe it was his idea. Am I right?
I think, you know, there would have been many, 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 many people, and certainly within the Labour Party of the time, you see.
Yeah.
I don't just kind of reserve this to the left here, because I think there was the insight for many people that we got an obligation here to the poor and to take responsibility for each other. But it's a no-brainer as far as, because so many of the hospitals were Christian anyway, you see. Mm. It's just that they didn't have the means to care on a widespread basis. It was all on a charitable basis. The NHS makes it government policy.
Looking at all the monasteries that have been dotted around the UK, let's say.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was at school, I was taught that, you know, a monastery at the bottom of their land, there'd be a hospice, a hospital. You know, they would provide the food. They would provide basic care for those travellers, but those that were ill as well. So if that was going on,
that's right,
at the height of the monastic culture, what's that, 11th, 12th century, something like that.
Yeah.
As you're saying, it's bound to have a profound effect, like this depth charge, throughout the later centuries.
I used to think of monasteries as these kind of places that were basically trying to escape the world. But actually, when you look at history, that's really not the case at all. Even the people who went out into the desert in the
Desert
kind of,
Fathers,
you know, fourth century, yeah, they actually set up communities in the desert, which became focuses for care and hospitality. And then that spreads across the Christian world of the time. And they become bases for culture, basically. They become places of learning, of education for people, but also for care. And it's no accident that word hospital is related so much to hospice.
Hospitality.
Yeah, in hospitality. Yeah, it's very much bound up with this vision of, I mean, when you look back at the Gospels and Jesus, what does he do? What's he doing in a lot of the Gospels? He's eating with people. He's having food with people, sitting around the table. And he's eating with all kinds of rascals.
Yeah.
Not the religious types. He's eating with the tax collectors and the publicans, you know, the prostitutes, the sinners. So you've got that vision of Jesus basically welcoming everybody to the table. I think that what happens in, you know, at its best in the Christian movement, in these quiet ways that grow into something big, this depth charge is this notion of extending the love of God, the care of God for us to everybody else. You know, that God does care for everybody in that way. But that's part of our agency. That's part of our responsibility.
You asked me off air before we started what's going to be the format. And basically what I was saying was, well, I've got a blank sheet of paper here, because so often with off-grid Christianity, we start off, or I start off with a few questions of where I think it's going to go. But this one, I just didn't know where it was going to run. And you very kindly, behind the scenes, has been working on ideas and what to talk about. But it seems to me, wrestling with your own faith is one thing, but wrestling your faith with politics is another thing. But don't, and I'm going to quote a Bible verse here, don't hide it under a bushel. You know, make sure you know what you can do, and converse with somebody. your loved one, talk it through. Yeah. They might come from an opposite point of view, but this is how we learn. Because if we are going to be Christians in a dark world and we've heard so many prophecies and everything else that's going on, look at the title, Off-Grid Christianity. There's got to be a time, surely, when we say, enough is enough. I don't want to go fighting over this because that'd be totally wrong. Mm. I just want to be an open channel so God can use me. There has to be that point whereby I go, right, I'm going to go for it, God. And politics surely must come into this. We need Christians from every persuasion, politically wise, to do something. So who comes to mind for you that has really flown the flag?
Well, I mean, one of my great heroes I didn't really get to talk about because I got to talking about my parents was Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
And King, I believe, really understood in profound ways this sense of agency that we all have, the duty, the obligations that we have to each other. You know, interestingly enough, I think he wrestles with this thing of, you know, how do you therefore approach politics when violence seems to be so much part of the way of the world and of politics? You know, he was a pacifist too, but a pacifist who believed in nonviolent resistance. It wasn't just nonviolence. Nonviolence can suggest you don't do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, you just withdraw. No, actually, you can be nonviolent and resist the power of evil, but you go and face up to it. You go and confront it. And obviously the evil that he was particularly keen to resist was the evil of racism, of segregation and discrimination in American society. And that's what he mobilized the whole crowd of people to follow him, to do, to resist the power of evil in the world, but in this kind of confrontational way, you know? And they developed a whole series of tactics which, you know, were quite aggressive in some ways, but aggressive in a non-violent way. You know, you get in the face of your enemy, but not to strike them. You try and actually persuade them. You try and convert them. Really interesting that the movement he founded, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, its kind of motto was to redeem the soul of America. And it's an extraordinary thing for a political movement. They were a political movement, no question about it. But the issue was a spiritual one behind the political change is actually not to kind of smite your enemy, to do away with them, to slay them. It's actually to redeem them, to convert them to your way of thinking. Now, how do you do that? You can't do it through violence. You can only do it through engagement, you know, a kind of confrontation, but an engagement that leads to this very profound communication. You know, sometimes we think of communication as this kind of one-way thing. I'm going to tell you what I think.
With loads of gesticulations and pointing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, I'm a great gesticulator, I'm afraid. My arms go everywhere. But actually, it is about this engagement. I mean, you mentioned the table, you know, eating around the table with my parents and discussing. Well, that's a great image, I think, for us to sit around the table. Communication is about community. Communication is actually very much two-way. This was the promise of the internet, wasn't it? Television is this kind of one-way thing.
Yes.
The internet, you can have social media, you can have back and forth. Unfortunately, it's become this kind of great echo chamber where all we're doing is kind of bellowing out our stuff and voicing all sorts of nonsense, conspiracy theories, bloody, bloody, blah. Whereas, you know, to sit down together face to face and have these conversations with people who we profoundly disagree with, but nevertheless, who we respect and, you know, are willing to kind of come to some sort of agreement with, some sort of negotiation with. That's deep. That was King's idea in this vision that he had to redeem the soul of America, because it was to create not this community where we're all the same, but a beloved community where we love and respect each other. Now, okay, that may sound incredibly naive and far-fetched, but I think it's profound.
Yes.
And, you know, we need to kind of recover this somewhere in our politics.
Talking is the way through. And just thinking from my point of view, the reason why I'm still a Christian now, I think, goes back to my days in the 80s and 90s, especially, you know, we'd go to the pub after, can I say, after a Bible study even, and you can chat and discuss things. It's amazing, really, because if everybody was listening to that, had a buzzer, if I mention the word pub, there might be a few people immediately pushing that buzzer saying, right, that's it, I'm not listening to it anymore. I'm offended because pub means this, means den of nicotine, means alcohol. And then other people be pushed about, oh, he's been drinking beer, push that.
Yeah, yeah.
We've got to have an open platform, surely, whereby you can discuss.
There's got to be, yeah. And I mean, this business of dealing with difference, again, is has been a thing that Christians have had to kind of recognize over time, I would say, and painfully in many ways. I mean, when you think about the wars of religion in the Middle Ages, you know, in the kind of early modern period, they were wars of religion among Christians. They were people who or both sides believed in Jesus, apparently, and they're going out and killing each other. Actually coming to this recognition that, no, we can't just be thinking, get rid of the people we disagree with. I mean, the classic example of this in a European context, tragically, is the Jews, isn't it? I mean, after the empire becomes Christian, what do you do with the Jews then? Because actually, throughout the Middle Ages, largely to be a citizen was to be a Christian. So to be excommunicated from the church in the Middle Ages was a desperately worrying, tragic thing. Because how are you going to live now? You can't be a citizen anymore because you're excommunicated, not just from this religious body, you're actually cut off from your citizenship. You're regarded as a pariah. Well, the Jews were the kind of classic example of this. And throughout the Middle Ages, Christians are really kind of, there's this struggle going on. What do we do with the Jews? And at one point in England and elsewhere in Britain, in across Europe, you shall not live among us as Jews, they said. So what do the Jews do then? Oh, well, you know, if they're going to remain in the society at all as human beings, as people, they've got to convert. So loads of them had to convert to Christianity. And then the Inquisition comes along. Well, did they really convert? Was it sincere? Or do they remain, you know, all of that stuff, which is a terrible thing. But you shall not live among us as Jews. And then some people, as in England in the Middle Ages, said, you shall not live among us. So it's not just as Jews, you shall not live among us. And they booted them out. They actually chucked out the Jews from Great Britain, you know, which is an extraordinary thing to do. And an entire population, get rid of them and, you know, move them out of there. But as some Jewish scholars have pointed out, what that actually leads to is to something even worse than that. You shall not live among us as Jews. You shall not live among us. Ends up as you shall not live. And so a lot of people see a straight link between the kind of Christian anti-Semitism of the Middle Ages and what happens in Germany during the Holocaust. That there's this kind of, okay, it was a pagan movement, it was a deeply un-Christian movement in so many ways, but it actually builds on something that was happening in Christian Europe for so long. You shall not live among us as Jews. You shall not live among us ends up, you shall not live. And it's genocide. You know, unfortunately, there are examples of smaller scale genocides that were happening throughout the Middle Ages. So the Jews are the classic example of difference, you know, for Christians. And we've had to struggle with that one. And we, you know, that was wrong. That was utterly, utterly wrong. That whole, you know, kind of enterprise. We've got to learn to live with difference, with people who are profoundly different to it, and because they have a dignity and a kind of a right as people made in the image of God that we have a fundamental obligation to respect.
I think you just nailed it, the very last sentence there. You know, we're all made in the image of God, and it doesn't matter what you actually believe in. Taking the absurd side of it, you might be a Bristol Rovers fan. I can't understand why anyone would want to be a Bristol Rovers fan. But I have to acknowledge that that's what he wants to believe or she wants to believe in. Mm. So we have to we have to accept that, surely. And it's communication again.
It is.
That's got to be it. I'm sorry for banging the drum. When I was a training officer, conflict resolution was such a big thing that we had to train on. And this was just in an interview.
Yeah.
And also in management, how do you come to terms? What is conflict resolution? And I became such a flag waver for it because I believed in it passionately. Conversation is the way through. Sit down and discuss. And in the remaining 5 or 6 minutes that we've got, Ewan, if that's okay, we're talking about faith wrestling with politics. If it boils down to communication, that's what I'm thinking. What are you thinking?
I think, yes, I mean, it does boil down to communication. And that means talking to people who we disagree with profoundly. And then realizing, okay, we've both got to live here. We've got to come to some understanding. And that might mean, therefore, certainly I'm expecting some changes from them to recognize who I am. Am I willing to recognize who they are? Am I willing to make room for them? Am I willing to let them be and to get on with life? Now, you know, I think there are some things over which, where we draw lines, you know, the sort of thing that is universally recognized now is the abuse of children, for example. We don't say, oh, we're going to kind of allow pederasty or paedophilia because that's your sexual inclination, you know. But, you know, so we draw a line there. But, I mean, there are plenty of other lines that we've drawn arbitrarily. They don't respect the conscience, the experience, the kind of engagement with the world of another group of people. I think this goes an awful lot for gay people now. And, you know, the way in which they've been kind of treated historically and viewed. And do we want to return to criminalizing homosexual behavior? Do we want to return to actually persecuting groups of people who are deemed different from us on that level? I certainly don't want to go back there. I think that the kind of place that we're at now, it isn't completely unreasonable. It is actually respecting other people and realize, you know, give them room to live, give them room to be. Let's talk about our views of life. How many Christians who kind of take a very, very hard line on homosexuality actually know homosexual people? Yeah. And sit down with them and talk about their lives and their experiences. So that is, I think, is a massive one. But the other thing that I would say in conclusion is that we mustn't give ourselves over to cynicism and despair of the political scene. I listen to people banging on about how awful Britain is and how corrupt it is and blah, blah, blah. We don't know the first thing about these things. You know, to say that all corrupt politicians are bent or in it for themselves, it's absolutely not true. Of course, there are people who are kind of bad apples in the pile, as it were. We're seeing maybe some of that at the moment with some of these scandals around. No, I mean, the vast majority of politicians are in it because they want to, you know, of all parties in Britain, are in it because they want to do good for their communities, for our society. I disagree with many of them. I've got very strong political views, but I don't accept that we can give ourselves over to the cynical view of politics. We live in a country where we are blessed. And why are we blessed? Because there's been incredible stability here. There's been a kind of sense of obligation from one to another, neighborliness. Those things are still there. They haven't disappeared. And they're still there in our politics as well. So I would simply urge Christians particularly and urge anybody who's kind of saying, you know, oh, you know, it's all gone to the dogs. No, it hasn't. We live in a very blessed country for all its faults. And there are many. But let's not take this for granted where we live. We are very, very blessed where we live on the face of the earth. Let's care about it. Let's keep tending it. Doing what we can to kind of, to have agency in our communities.
I think also faith wrestling with politics, that's what we're going to call it now. Mm. People that are listening today, let's take it a bit further for them. If they feel deep down inside that they've got a passion about a certain subject and they want to do something about it, they could actually help the community, but they're afraid that maybe their loved one might sort of scoff at them or put them down or whatever. But if there's a burning ambition inside them, maybe that is God-given.
Yeah.
From all your history point of view and from what you've done in your past and everything else like that, For those that listen that have something burning inside them, what would you say to them to do? What would be the first thing to do?
I think you've got to honor that flame that's inside you. You've got to honor that. That's something that does matter if you're really passionate about it. So therefore, educate yourself more on that, you know, inquire further into it. But you got to honor it. You can't just ignore it. That could be something. I mean, it could be nuts. It could be, you know, so that's, you got to talk to other people about it. That passion you've got. But if it's real, it will flourish and it will grow. And you've got to allow it to do that, because that could be something really God-given. That could be a gift to others, you know. And I think the gifts that we have, that God has given us, are always for others, actually, and for the glory of God, and the glory of creation. So honor it. And if it's real, it'll, you know, it'll grow, and you'll find ways to make it live. Yeah. And it might mean that you've got to stand for office. It might mean that you've got to actually think, okay, I need to take a stand on this one in my job or in my organization. And that could be in the church as well. I mean, it's so easy to think, oh, it's all sorted. We got it all sorted in Christian institutions. No, Christian institutions are often the worst, actually. In my experience, the BBC was a far more humane employer, for example, than I've seen in plenty of Christian employers. And in the way it dealt with conflict and, you know, differences of opinion and stuff like that. It was not a perfect organization at all, but there was real struggling to kind of honor the difference within an organization and principle and so on. And I think Christian institutions have to take that seriously as well. But yeah, if you've got something burning within you, you got to take it seriously. You got to examine it. You got to talk about it with others. And then if it's real, it'll grow. Where's it going to go with this? Well, it might end up with something really nasty, like being burnt at the stake. That's happened in history to people who really believed stuff and stood for their principles. But it might end up with something that is actually an acknowledgement by others, as with King, I think, that his vision was something for all of us. It wasn't just for black people. It wasn't just for the whites who were kind of oppressed. It's actually, his vision is something that has been taken on around the world, and we've grown as a human race, I think, through that.
Yeah. Well, anyone that mentions Martin Luther King is all right by me. That's all I could say, because he was a phenomenal person.
He was a man of faults. He was a man of sin. Sin runs through all of us. And that's the paradox of all of this, I think. The paradox of life in this world is it's God's world. It's a good world. Power, in the way that God intends it, is a good thing. But we are sinners, all of us. Not just the great unwashed out there, as it were, but me. I'm part of this world of sin. And my passions, my desires can be warped just like anybody else's. So we've got to balance these things. We got to balance power in the world in a way that I think at its best democracy does. There's a great quote by Reinhold Niebuhr, who's a really powerful Christian thinker about democracy in the 20th century. He says that man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible. Man's capacity for injustice makes democracy necessary. You need to actually hedge power around with all of these safeguards, with all of these, like losing an election, for example, like the ability to be boot people out of power if they're corrupt. Man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible, makes man's capacity for injustice, makes democracy necessary. Now, I think that's taking the human experience, the human reality, in a biblical way, really seriously. It's taking power and our God-given, you know, duties in this world seriously, to exercise power, but it's also taking sin seriously, the abuse of those powers. You know, we got to watch that as well.
Yeah.
How do you balance them? That's the wrestle of politics.
Wow. Well, time has beaten us yet again, Ewan. What a subject. I said at the beginning, you know, we had a blank sheet of paper and we thought, well, we'll call it faith wrestling with politics. We've only just really scratched the surface.
Completely.
I'm hoping that people who've listened to this today will think, yeah, do you know what? Conversation, that's the way to go. I might be of one political persuasion. my spouse might be another, but let's just talk about it without get angry and see if anything good can come out of it. Whereby, as you said, you know, I have to respect what you're thinking, they have to respect what I'm thinking. Maybe you can come up with an idea where both your ideas work together, dare I say, in a marriage. My wife has a completely different mindset to me because she's a woman, I'm a man. But when you put her thoughts on it and my thoughts on it, actually you can come up with a better plan. So I'm beginning to preach now.
Yeah.
But I'd like to thank you so much, Ian, for this. And the way my mind works as well. Every time you mentioned the Inquisition, I kept thinking, nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
The Spanish Inquisition, exactly. And we always think the Spanish Inquisition is somebody else rather than us.
Yeah.
Nobody expects. I'm sure I've been part of the Spanish Inquisition in my time with my kids, my colleagues, you know. That instinct is in all of us, unfortunately.
And I'll leave you this final question. And I thank you so much for joining us today, Ewan. Talk about the Middle Ages. Where was the Magna Carta signed?
Runnymede?
No, at the bottom. It's a very old joke. It's one of the first jokes I was told.
Very good.
Thank you. Ewan Russell Jones, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been amazing. And if anybody wants to know any more or suggest anything or say, well, actually, this is what's happened, please let us know. Email us at ogc@accessradio.biz. And I can gladly pass on any emails to yourself as well, Ewan.
And as they used to say, vote well, vote often.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Ewan. God bless.
Cheers.